The National Guards from the suburbs raced in swiftly and chaotically. A battalion of the 12th Light galloped in from Saint-Denis. The 14th of the line arrived from Courbevoie. The batteries of the École Militaire took up position at the Carousel. The artillery came across from Vincennes. The Tuileries were isolated. Louis-Philippe was perfectly serene. Originality of Paris. In the past 2 years, as we said, Paris had seen more than one insurrection. Outside the insurgent quartier, nothing is more weirdly calm, as a rule, than the face of Paris during a riot. Paris very quickly gets used to everything. It's only a riot, and Paris is so busy that it does not trouble itself for so little. Only such colossal cities can offer such spectacles. Only such vast enclosures can contain civil war and an indescribably odd tranquility at the same time. Usually, when an insurrection kicks off, when you hear the drums, the recall, the alarm call, the shopkeeper is content merely to say, "Looks like there's a bit of trouble, Rue Saint-Martin, or Faubourg Saint-Antoine." Often he adds, nonchalantly, "Somewhere over that way." Later, when the harrowing and mournful din of musketry and the gunfire of platoons makes itself heard, the shopkeeper says, "So things are heating up, eh? Well, 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 they're heating up." A moment later, if the riot gets closer and bigger, he swiftly shuts up shop and throws on his uniform. In other words, he secures his merchandise and puts his person at risk. People shoot at each other at street corners, in arcades, in dead-end streets. Barricades are taken, lost, and taken back. Blood flows, house fronts are riddled with grapeshot, bullets kill people in their beds, dead bodies choke the pavements. A few streets away, you can hear the clinking of billiard balls in the cafes. The curious laugh and chatter 2 feet away from these streets full of war. The theatres open their doors and perform vaudeville. The fiacres roll along, people go off to dine en ville, sometimes in the very quartier where the fighting is going on. In 1831, a fusillade was suspended to let a wedding party pass. In the insurrection of May 12, 1839, in the Rue Saint-Martin, a rickety little old man dragging a handcart with a tricolour cloth over it and carrying carafes filled with some kind of liquid came and went from the barricade to the troops and from the troops to the barricade, impartially offering glasses of licorice water, now to the government, now to the anarchists. Nothing could be weirder, and that is precisely the nature of the riots peculiar to Paris, which you will not find in any other capital. Two things are needed for this: the greatness of Paris and its gaiety. You need the city of Voltaire and the city of Napoleon. Yet this time, in the military parade of June 5, 1832, the great city felt something that was perhaps greater than it. It felt fear. Everywhere, in the most remote and uninvolved quartiers, you saw doors, windows, and shutters closed in the middle of the day. The brave armed themselves, cowards hid. The insouciant, bustling men on foot disappeared. Many streets were as empty as they would be at 4 o'clock in the morning. Alarming details made the rounds, ominous news was spread like wildfire. It was said that they had gained control of the Banque de France, that in the Saint-Merry cloister alone there were 600 of them entrenched and fortified in the church, that the line was not secure, that Armand Carrel had been to see the Maréchal Clausel, and that the Maréchal had said, "Get a regiment together first," that Lafayette was sick, but had told them anyhow, "I am at your disposal, I'll follow you wherever there's room for a chair," that everyone had to stay on their guard, that come nightfall there would be people looting isolated houses in the deserted corners of Paris. Here you could detect the imagination of the police at work, that Anne Radcliffe embedded in the government, that a battery had been planted in the Rue Aubry-le-Boucher, that Lobau and Bugeaud were conferring, and that at midnight or at daybreak at the latest, four columns would march at the same time on the centre of the riot, the first coming from the Bastille, the second from the Porte Saint-Martin, the third from La Grève, the fourth from Les Halles, that perhaps the troops would also evacuate Paris and withdraw to the Champ de Mars, that no one knew what would happen, but that one thing was for sure, and that was that, this time, it was serious. Everyone was worried about Maréchal Soult's holding back. Why didn't he attack right away? One thing is certain, and that was that he was deeply absorbed. The old lion seemed to scent some unknown monster in the shadows. Evening came. The theatres did not open. The patrols did the rounds, looking peevish. Pedestrians were searched. Suspects were arrested. By 9 o'clock, more than 800 people had been arrested. The prefecture of police was packed. The conciergerie was packed. La Force was packed. At the conciergerie, in particular, the long underground tunnel known as the Rue de Paris was strewn with bundles of straw on which a heap of prisoners lay, being harangued valiantly by Lagrange, the man from Lyon. The rustling of all that straw, tossed around by all those men, made a noise like a shower of rain. Elsewhere, prisoners lay in the open air in the prison yards, piled on top of each other. A feeling of foreboding was everywhere, and a certain tremulousness, most unusual for Paris. People barricaded themselves in their houses. Wives and mothers fretted. All you heard was, "Oh, my God, he hasn't come home." In the distance, carriages were only very rarely heard bowling along. People listened on their doorsteps to the noise, the shouting, the commotion, the muted and indistinct sounds, things about which they said, "That's the cavalry," or "That's the caissons galloping along." The bugles, the drums, the fusillades, and especially the mournful tocsin of Saint-Merry. Everyone was waiting for the first cannonball to be fired. Armed men surged up at street corners and then vanished, shouting, "Go home!" And everyone bolted their doors as fast as they could. They said, "How will it all end?" With each passing moment, as night came down and the twilight thickened, Paris seemed to redden ever more woefully with the fearful blaze of the riot. Book 11. The Atom Fraternizes with the Hurricane. Some insights into the origins of Gavroche's poetry. Influence of an academician on this poetry. At the instant that the insurrection, arising from the clash between the people and the troops in front of the arsenal, inspired a backing off in the multitude who were following the hearse, and who, all the way along the boulevards, weighed, so to speak, on the head of the convoy, there was a terrible backward surge. The crowd rocked, the rows broke up, everyone ran, took to their heels, escaped, some with battle cries, others with the pallor of flight. The great river that covered the boulevards split in the twinkling of an eye, overflowing to left and right and pouring in torrents down 200 streets at once, streaming like water through open sluice gates. At that moment, a ragged little boy, who was coming down the Rue Ménilmontant, holding in his hand a branch of laburnum in bloom, which he had just picked on the heights of Belleville, caught sight of an old horse pistol in the shop window of a bric-a-brac dealer's. He threw his flowering branch on the pavement and said, "Mother, what's it? I think I'll just borrow your thingy." And he ran off with the pistol. 2 minutes later, a flood of terrified bourgeois fleeing down the Rue Amelot and the Rue Basse ran into the boy, brandishing his pistol and singing, "You can't see a thing at night, of a day all's clear and bright. A spurious note gets your burger by the throat, so please be good, pointy-headed hood." It was little Gavroche going off to war. It wasn't till he was on the boulevard that he saw that the pistol had no hammer. Who wrote this refrain that helped him keep time as he walked along, and all the other songs that on occasion he liked to sing? We have no idea. Who knows? Maybe he did. In any case, Gavroche was up with all the popular ditties in circulation, and he put in his own babble to boot. An imp and a little devil, he made a medley of the voices of nature and the voices of Paris. He combined the repertoire of the birds with the repertoire of the workshops. He knew some artists' apprentices, a tribe closely related to his own. He had been, it seems, an apprentice printer for 3 months. One day he had done an errand for Monsieur Baour-Lormien, one of the 40. Gavroche was a gamin of letters. Besides, Gavroche had no idea that on that horrible rainy night when he had offered two little mites the hospitality of his elephant, it was for his own brothers that he had played the part of Providence. His brothers in the evening, his father next morning, such had been his night. when he came out of the Rue de Ballet just after dawn. He had rushed back to the elephant, had artfully extracted the two little boys, had shared whatever he was able to invent for breakfast, then gone off again, handing them over to that excellent mother, the street, who had more or less raised him. As he was leaving them, he arranged to meet them that same evening at the same place, and had left them with these words by way of goodbye. "I'm going to beat it. In other words, I'm taking off, or, as they say at court, I'll skedaddle. Kidlingtons, if you don't find Mummy and Daddy, come back this evening. I'll rustle up some tucker for you and put you up for the night." The two little boys picked up by some police officer and parked at the station, or stolen by some traveling showman, or simply lost in the vast Chinese puzzle that is Paris, had not returned. The dregs of our current social world are full of such lost traces. Gavroche had not seen them again. 10 or 12 weeks had gone by since that night. More than once he had scratched his head and asked himself, "Where the devil are my two children?" Meanwhile, pistol in hand, he had reached the Rue du Pont aux Choux. He noticed that there was only one shop open in that street, and something that gave pause for thought, it was a patisserie. This was a heaven-sent opportunity to eat another apple turnover before launching into the unknown. Gavroche stopped, patted his sides, fumbled in his fob gusset, turned his pockets inside out, found nothing, not a sou, and began to shout, "Help!" It is hard to miss out on the greatest cake there is. Gavroche went on his way, anyway. 2 minutes later, he was in the Rue Saint-Louis. Crossing the Rue du Parc Royal, he felt the need to compensate himself for the impossible apple turnover, and so gave himself the immense pleasure of tearing down the theater posters in broad daylight. A bit farther along, seeing a group of well-heeled burghers go by who looked to him to be men of property, he shrugged his shoulders and randomly spat out this mouthful of philosophical bile. "These rich bastards, God, they're fat, they stuff themselves, they wallow in fine dinners. Ask them what they do with their money, they haven't got a clue. They eat it. That's what they do with it. Gone with the wind of the gut." Gavroche on the march. Waving a hammerless, dogless pistol around in your hand in the middle of the street is such a public service that Gavroche felt his verve increasing with each step. He shouted between the snatches of the Marseillaise that he was singing, "All's well. My left paw hurts like blazes. My rheumatism's killing me, but I am happy, citizens. All the bourgeois have to do is behave themselves. I'll belt out a few subversive lines for them. What are stool pigeons? They're dogs, by jingo. But let's have a bit of respect for dogs. I could use a dog myself on my pistol. I've come from the boulevard, my friends. It's getting hot. It's simmering along nicely. It's nearly on the boil. Time to give the pot a good skim. Forward, men! Let impure blood flood our furrows. I give my life for the homeland. I'll never see my concubine again. Hey, nanny nanny, all over. Yes, ninny, gone. But who cares? Long live joy. Let's have it out, damn it. I've had a gutful of despotism." At that instant, the horse of a National Guard lancer riding past came crashing down. Gavroche laid his pistol on the ground and pulled the man up. Then he helped pull up the horse, after which he picked up his pistol and continued on his way. In the Rue de Torigny, all was peace and quiet. This apathetic stillness, peculiar to the Marais, contrasted with the vast surrounding uproar. 4 gossips were jabbering away on a doorstop. Scotland has its trios of witches, but Paris has its quartets of gossips. And the "Thou shalt be king hereafter," hurled at Macbeth on the heath at Armure, would be just as ominous hurled at Bonaparte in the Baudoyer Square. The croaking would be more or less the same. The gossips of the Rue de Torigny were exclusively caught up in their own affairs. 3 of them were porters, and the other one, with her sack and her hook, was the rag-and-bone dealer, cum garbage collector that is known as a chiffonnier. They seemed, all 4 of them, to be standing at the 4 corners of old age, decay, decrepitude, ruin, and sorrow. The rag-and-bone woman was humble. In this all-weather world, the rag-and-bone woman greets, the porter protects. It all depends on where the concierge draws the boundary line, for the pickings may be big or small according to the whim of whoever is sweeping the garbage into a pile. Even a broom can show goodwill. This particular rag-and-bone woman was a grateful old sack, and she smiled, what a smile, to the 3 porter women. The talk ran along the following lines.
Heavens, so your cat's still mean?
My God, cats, you know, are the natural enemy of dogs. It's the dogs that have something to complain about.
People, too.
And yet cat fleas don't go after people. That's not the trouble. Dogs is dangerous. I remember one year when there were so many dogs they were forced to put it in the papers. It was the days when they had great big sheep in the Tuileries that used to pull the little carriage of the King of Rome. You remember the King of Rome?
Me, I was fond of the Duc de Bordeaux.
Me, I knew Louis XVII. I prefer Louis XVII.
Meat's dear, ma Patagon.
Ah, don't talk to me about meat. The butchers is shocking, truly shocking. All they've got now is tough old leftovers.
Here the rag-and-bone woman broke in.
Ladies, trade's poor, the garbage piles are lousy. No one's throwing anything away these days. They eat everything.
There's poorer folks than you, Vargoulême.
Well, that's true, replied the rag-and-bone woman deferentially. Me, I've got a job.
There was a pause, and the rag-and-bone woman, yielding to that need for display that is at the bottom of mankind, added,
In the morning, when I get home, I go through the sack. I take me peck.
Probably pick.
I do me sortie.
Probably sorting.
I end up with great heaps in me room. I put the rags in a basket, the scraps in a tub, the linen in me cupboard, the woolens in me chest of drawers, the old papers in a corner of the window, anything worth eating in me bowl, the bits of glass in the fireplace, the old shoes behind the door, and the bones under me bed.
Gavroche, who had stopped behind, was listening.
Hey, old girls, he said. What business do you have talking politics?
A volley assailed him, composed of a quadruple hissing and booing.
There's another little stinker for you. What's he got in his mitt then, a pistol? I ask you, a slip of a kid like that. It's not happy unless it's knocking over authority.
Gavroche, contemptuous, restricted himself by way of retort to lifting his nose with his thumb while opening his hand completely.
The rag-and-bone woman cried, Cheeky little tramp!
The one who answered to the name of Patagon clapped her hands together, scandalized.
There's going to be trouble, that's for sure. That little shyster next door with his goatee, I see him go past every morning with a young thing and a paint cap on his arm. Today I saw him go past and he was giving his arm to a musket. Ma Bachot reckons there was a revolution just this last week at where's that cow of a place? Pontoise. And then this look at me here with his pistol, this horrible little twerp. Apparently there are cannons all over the Celestin. What do you want the government to do with little wastrels who've got nothing better to do than think of ways to upset everyone just when things were starting to quiet down a bit again after all the troubles we've had? Lord Almighty, that poor queen I seen go by in the cart, and it's all going to send the prices up. It's a disgrace. No doubt about it, I'll be going to see you guillotined, you little swine.
You're sniffling, old girl, said Gavroche. Blow your hooter, why don't you?
And he moved on. When he had got to the Rue Pavée, the rag-and-bone woman came back into his mind, and he uttered this soliloquy. You are wrong to insult revolutionaries, Mother Guttersweep. This pistol here is to act on your behalf. It's so you have more stuff worth eating in your sack. All of a sudden he heard a noise behind him. It was the porter woman, Patagon, who had followed him and who, from a distance, was showing him her fist and shouting,
You are nothing but a bastard.
As for that, said Gavroche, I am profoundly indifferent. Soon after, he was passing the Hôtel La Moignon. There he let out this call, En route for battle! And he was overcome by a fit of melancholy. He looked at his pistol with an air of reproach as though he was trying to soften it. I go off, he said, but you can't go off. One dog may distract attention from another. A very skinny poodle had just walked past. Gavroche was moved to pity.
You poor little pooch, he said to it. Did you swallow a barrel then, for your ribs to be sticking out everywhere like that?
Then he headed for the Orme Saint-Gervais. A wigmaker's just indignation. The worthy wigmaker who had chased away the two little boys to whom Gavroche had opened the elephant's paternal intestines was at this moment in his shop, busy shaving an old legionnaire who had served under the Empire. They were chatting. The wigmaker had naturally spoken to the veteran about the riot, then, about General Lamarque, and from Lamarque they had come to the Emperor. Hence, a conversation between a barber and a soldier, which Prudhomme, had he been there, would have embellished with a flourish or two and called Dialogue of the Razor and the Sabre.
Monsieur, said the wigmaker, how did the Emperor mount his horse?
Badly. He didn't know how to fall. So he never did. Did he have beautiful horses? He must have had beautiful horses. The day he gave me the cross, I noticed his nag. She was a racing mare, all white. She had wide set ears, a deep saddle, a fine head with a black mark like a star, a very long neck, strongly jointed knees, protruding ribs, sloping shoulders, a powerful rump. A bit over 15 hands high.
A nice horse, said the wigmaker.
It was His Majesty's animal.
The wigmaker felt that after those words a small pause was appropriate, which he observed, and then resumed.
The Emperor was only ever wounded once, monsieur. Isn't that so?
The old soldier replied in the calm and sovereign tone of one who was there. In the heel, at Ratisbon. I never saw him so spruced up as that day. He was as shiny as a pin.
What about you, monsieur le vétéran? You must have been wounded quite a bit.
Me? Said the soldier. Nothing much. At Marengo I caught a couple of saber slashes on the back of the neck. A bullet in my right arm at Austerlitz, another in my left hip at Jena, a jab with a bayonet at Friedland, here in Moscow 7 or 8 thrusts of a lance, here, there, and everywhere. In Lützen a shell burst and crushed a finger. And then at Waterloo, a Biscay musket ball in the thigh. That's about it.
What a beautiful thing,
cried the wigmaker in a Pindaric tone,
to die on the field of battle.
Me, word of honour, rather than croak in the cot of illness, slowly, a bit more every day, with drugs and poultices and syringes and the doctor, I'd rather catch a cannonball in the guts.
You're not squeamish, said the soldier.
He had only just finished when a dreadful crash shook the shop. One of the window panes in the shop front had suddenly been shattered. The wigmaker went white.
My God! He yelped. There's one now!
What?
A cannonball!
Here it is, said the soldier. And he picked up something that was rolling on the ground. It was a pebble.
The wigmaker ran to the broken window and saw Gavroche running away as fast as his legs would carry him toward the Saint-Jean market. As he was going past the wigmaker's, Gavroche, who had the two little kids on his mind, had not been able to resist the desire to greet him and had thrown a stone through his window.
"You see that?" screamed the wigmaker, who had gone from white to purple. "He makes trouble for the heck of it. What did anyone ever do to that kid, anyway?"
The boy marvels at the old man. Meanwhile, Gavroche, at the Saint-Jean market, where the guards posted were already disarmed, had joined up with a gang led by Enjolras, Courfeyrac, Combeferre, and Fouilly. They were more or less armed. Barrel and Jean Prouvaire caught up with them and swelled their number. Enjolras had a double-barreled fowling piece. Combeferre, a National Guard fusil bearing the number of the Legion, as well as 2 pistols in his belt that his unbuttoned overcoat revealed. Jean Prouvaire, an old cavalry carbine. Barrel, a hunting rifle. And Courfeyrac was waving around an unsheathed sword cane. Fouilly, a drawn saber in his hand, was marching in front, crying, "Long live Poland!" They were coming from the Quai Morland, cravatless, hatless, breathless, soaked by the rain, lightning in their eyes. Gavroche calmly accosted them.
"Where are we going?"
"Come along," said Courfeyrac. Behind Fouilly, Barrel was marching, or rather bounding, a fish in the water of the riot. He was wearing a crimson waistcoat, and he was swearing like a trooper. One passerby was bowled over by his waistcoat and cried out, frantic, "Here come the Reds!"
"The Reds! The Reds!" replied Barrel. "What are you frightened of, my good bourgeois? You won't see me trembling at the sight of a red poppy. Little Red Riding Hood does not inspire me with horror. Bourgeois, believe me, we ought to leave fear of red to horned beasts."
He eyed a bit of wall plastered with the most pacific sheet of paper in the world, an authorization to eat eggs, the pastoral letter for Lent from the Archbishop of Paris to his flock. Barrel shouted,
"Flock! That's a polite way of saying sheep!"
And he ripped the pastoral letter off the wall. This won Gavroche over. From that moment, Gavroche began to study Barrel closely.
"Barrel," observed Enjolras, "you're wrong. You should have left that pastoral letter alone. That's not what we're about. You're wasting your anger on nothing. Hold your fire. You don't shoot outside the ranks any more with your soul than you do with your gun."
"To each his own, Enjolras," Barrel shot back. "This bishop's prose shocks me.
I want to be able to eat eggs without someone authorizing me to do so. You're the burning ice type. Me, I have fun. Besides, I'm not wasting my anger, I'm just warming up, and if I rip up pastoral letters, by Hercules, it's only to work up an appetite.
That word, Hercules, struck Gavroche. He was always looking for any opportunity to educate himself, and this ripper-upper of posters had gained his esteem. He asked him, "What does that mean, Hercules?"
Bahorel answered, "It means holy hell in Latin."
Here, Bahorel recognized a pale young man with a black beard at a window, watching them go past, probably a friend of the ABC. He shouted to him, "Quick! Cartridges! Parabellum!"
"Bellum! Handsome! It's true!" said Gavroche, who now understood Latin.
A boisterous cortege accompanied them. Students, artists, young men affiliated with the Cougou de Dex, workers, dockers, armed with clubs and bayonets, some like Combeferre with pistols stuck in their trousers. An old man, who looked really old, was marching with this band. He had no weapon, and was rushing so as not to be left behind, although he looked lost in thought. Gavroche spotted him.
"What's that?"
he said to Courfeyrac.
"Some old man."
It was Monsieur Mabeuf. The old man. Here's what had happened. Enjolras and his friends were on the Boulevard Bourdon, near the grain warehouses, just as the dragoons had charged. Enjolras, Courfeyrac, and Combeferre were among those who took to the Rue Bassompierre, shouting to the barricades. In the Rue Lesdiguières, they had run into an old man walking along. What got their attention was that this old man was zigzagging from one side of the street to the other as if he were drunk. On top of that, he had his hat in his hand, even though it had rained all morning, and it was raining pretty hard at that very moment. Courfeyrac had recognized old Mabeuf. He knew him from having seen him many times walking Marius to the front door. Knowing the peaceful and more than shy habits of the old churchwarden bookworm, and amazed to see him in the midst of all the mayhem, 2 feet from the cavalry charges, almost in the middle of a fusillade, bareheaded in the pouring rain and strolling among the bullets, he went over to him, and the 25-year-old rioter and the octogenarian had exchanged this dialogue.
"Monsieur Mabeuf, go home."
"Why?" "There's going to be some strife."
"Good."
"Sword thrusts and gunshot, Monsieur Mabeuf."
"Good."
"Cannon fire."
"Good. Where are you off to, you fellows?"
"We're off to overthrow the government."
"Good."
And he started to follow them. From that moment, he had not said a word. His stride suddenly became firm. A few workmen had offered him their arm, but he had refused with a shake of the head. He had surged ahead practically to the front of the column, his movements both those of a man on the march and of a sleeping man at once.
"There's a great old militant for you," murmured the students.
The rumor rippled through the crowd that he was a former member of the convention, an old regicide. The company had turned into the Rue de la Verrerie. Little Gavroche marched at the head, singing this song at the top of his lungs, like a kind of bugler. He sang, "Here's the moon coming out. Let's go to the forest roundabout." Charlot said to Charlotte, "Two, two, two, for Chateau. I have only one god, one king, one sou, and one boot. Early in the morning, having fasted, 2 sparrows drank the dew on the thyme and got plastered. Zee, 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 for Passy. I have only one god, one king, one sou, and one boot. And those 2 poor wolf cubs were stewed like 2 grubs. In his lair, a tiger had a good hoot. Don, 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 for me, don. I have only one god, one king, one sou, and one boot. One swore and the other cursed. We'll go to the forest or I'll burst," Charlot said to Charlotte. "Ta, ta, ta, for Pantin. I have only one god, one king, one sou, and one boot." They made their way toward Saint-Merry. Recruits. The band was growing by the second. Near the Rue des Billettes, a tall man, graying, whose rough and reckless mien Courfeyrac, Enjolras, and Combeferre remarked on, but whom none of them knew, joined them. Gavroche, busy singing, whistling, humming, charging ahead and banging shop shutters with the butt of his hammerless pistol, paid the man no attention. As it happened, in the Rue de la Verrerie, they went past Courfeyrac's door.
"This is a stroke of luck," said Courfeyrac. "I forgot my purse and I lost my hat."
He peeled off from the crowd and bounded upstairs to his place, four steps at a time. He grabbed an old hat and his purse. He also grabbed a fairly large square box, the size of a big suitcase that was hidden in his dirty washing. As he was running back down again, the concierge hailed him, "Monsieur de Courfeyrac!"
"Portress, what is your name?"
Courfeyrac shot back. The portress was baffled.
"Why, you know very well. I'm the concierge. My name is Mother Vervin."
"Well, then, if you call me Monsieur de Courfeyrac again, I'll call you Mother du Vauvin. Now speak, what is it? What's up?"
"There's someone here who wants to talk to you."
"Who's that?"
"I don't know."
"Where are they?"
"In my lodge."
"Blast them," said Courfeyrac.
"But he's been waiting for over an hour for you to come back," the portress insisted.
At the same time, a sort of young workman, thin, pale, small, freckled, dressed in a torn smock and patched-up corduroy trousers, who looked more like a girl playing a boy than a man, came out of the lodge and told Courfeyrac, in a voice that was certainly not in any way like a woman's voice,
"Monsieur Marius, please."
"He's not in."
"Will he be back this evening?"
"I haven't a clue."
Courfeyrac added, "As for me, I won't be back."
The young man looked him steadily in the eye and asked him,
"Why is that?"
"Because."
"Where are you off to, then?"
"What's it to you?"
"Would you like me to carry your box?"
"I'm off to the barricades."
"Would you like me to go with you?"
"If you like," answered Courfeyrac. "The street's free. The cobblestones belong to everyone."
And he ran off to catch up with his friends. When he caught up with them, he gave the box to one of them to carry. It was only a good 15 minutes later that he saw that the young man had, indeed, tagged along behind. A crowd that gathers does not exactly go where it would like. We explained that it is swept along by the wind. They passed Saint-Marie and found themselves, without really knowing how, in the Rue Saint-Denis. Book 12. Corinthe. History of Corinthe from its foundation. Parisians today, who enter the Rue Rambuteau, coming from Les Halles, and notice, on their right, opposite the Rue Mondétour, a basket weaver's shop whose sign is a basket in the shape of the Emperor Napoleon the Great, with this inscription, "Napoleon is made entirely of wickerwork," have no inkling of the terrible scenes that this same spot saw barely 30 years ago. This is the site of the Rue de la Chanvrerie, which used to be spelled Chanvrerie in old deeds, as well as the famous tavern known as Corinthe. You will recall all that has been said about the barricade put up on this spot and eclipsed, as it happens, by the barricade at Saint-Marie. It is over this famous barricade, in the Rue de la Chanvrerie, nowadays vanished into the mists of time, that we will now throw a little light. I hope, for the sake of the tale's clarity, we may be allowed to resort to a simple device already used on Waterloo. Anyone wanting to get a pretty precise image of the jumble of houses that stood in those days near the tip of Saint-Eustache, at the northeast corner of Les Halles of Paris, where the Rue Rambuteau comes out today, has only to imagine an N joining the Rue Saint-Denis at the top and Les Halles at the bottom. The two vertical strokes would be the Rue de la Grande Truanderie and the Rue de la Chanvrerie, and the horizontal stroke would be the Rue de la Petite Truanderie. The old Rue Mondétour cut the three strokes at the most tortured angles, so much so that the tangled maze of the four streets was enough to create, over a space of less than 200 square yards, between Les Halles and the Rue Saint-Denis on one side, and between the Rue de Cygne and the Rue des Prêcheurs on the other, seven islands of houses, bizarrely shaped, of varying sizes, placed crookedly and apparently randomly and barely separated like blocks of stone on a building site by narrow crevices. We say narrow crevices, and we can't give a better idea of these dark, constricted, angular lanes bordered by eight-story slums. These slums were so decrepit that, in the streets of La Chanvrerie and de la Petite Truanderie, the façades were propped up by wooden beams that ran from one house to the next. The street was narrow and the gutters wide, so anyone walking along had to wend their way on a pavement that was always wet, alongside shops like cellars, great big iron-hooped curbstones, unbelievable mounds of garbage, alley gates fortified with enormous age-old grills. the Rue Rambuteau laid waste to all that. The name Mondétour wonderfully conjures up the way the whole of this road network snaked around. A bit farther along, this was even better expressed by the Rue Pirouette, which flowed into the Rue Mondétour. The pedestrian coming from the Rue Saint-Denis and going into the Rue de la Chanvrerie saw it gradually shrivel away in front of him as though he had stepped into an elongated funnel. At the end of the street, which was incredibly short, he found the way barred on the Les Halles side by a tall row of houses, and he would have thought himself in a dead end if he did not see, to right and left, two black trenches down which he could escape. This was the Rue Mondétour, which went off to join the Rue des Prêcheurs on one side, and on the other, the Rue du Cygne and the Rue de la Petite Ronderie. At the bottom of this sort of dead end, at the corner of the right-hand trench, he noticed a house that was not nearly as tall as the rest, and that formed a sort of promontory on the street. It is in this house, only two stories high, that an illustrious tavern had been merrily chugging along for the past 300 years. This tavern made a joyous racket on the very spot old Théophile noted in these two lines, "Here bobs the horrible skeleton of a poor lover who hanged himself." The position was good, and the tavern was handed down from father to son. In the days of Mathurin Regnier, the tavern was called the Pot aux Roses, and as plays on words were all the rage, the sign was a post, poteau, painted rose pink. In the last century, the worthy Natoire, one of the masters of whimsy, now scorned by the school of rigidity, having gotten tipsy several times in this tavern, at the very table where Regnier got plastered, had painted a bunch of Corinth grapes on a rose pink post, out of gratitude. The publican gleefully changed his sign and had these words done in gold letters below the bunch of grapes, "Au raisin de Corinthe," hence the name Corinthe. Nothing comes more naturally to staggering drunks than elliptical expressions. The elliptical expression is the zigzagging phrase. Corinthe had gradually dethroned the Pot aux Roses. The last publican of the dynasty, old man Hucheloup, not even having a clue about the tradition anymore, had had the post painted blue. A downstairs room where the bar was, a room on the first floor where the billiard table was, a wooden spiral staircase going through the ceiling, wine on the tables, soot on the walls, candles in broad daylight, that was what the tavern was like. A stairwell with a trapdoor in the basement room led to the cellar. On the second floor were the Hucheloup's rooms. You went up by a staircase, more like a ladder than a staircase, the only entrance being a door hidden in the main room on the first floor. Under the roof, two garrets with dormer windows, servants' nests. The kitchen shared the ground floor with the barroom. Old Father Hucheloup may have been a born chemist. He was certainly a cook. You not only drank in his tavern, you ate there. Hucheloup had invented an excellent thing you could only get at his establishment, and that was stuffed carp, which he called carpe au gras. This was eaten by the light of a tallow candle or an oil lamp from the days of Louis XVI on tables where an oilskin was nailed down as a tablecloth. People came from miles around. One fine day, Hucheloup decided the time had come to alert the passing trade to his specialty. He dipped a brush into a pot of black, and as his spelling was peculiar to him, just like his cooking, he improvised on a wall outside this remarkable inscription, "Carpe au gras." One winter the storms and squalls got it into their heads to wipe out the S at the end of the first word and the G at the start of the third. And this is what was left, "Carpe horas." With the help of time and the rain, a humble gastronomical advertisement had become a profound piece of advice. Seize the hours. And so it was that, not knowing French, old Father Hucheloup had come up with Latin and brought philosophy out of the kitchen. Wanting simply to erase Lent, he had equaled horas. And the striking thing was that this also meant, "Come into my tavern." Not a trace of all this exists today. The Mondétour maze was ripped up and largely opened up in 1847, and may well be no more at the present time. The Rue de la Chanvrerie has disappeared, and Corinthe with it, under the pavement of the Rue Rambuteau.
As we said, Corinth was one of those places where Courfeyrac and his friends gathered, if not rallied. It was Grantaire who had discovered Corinth. He had gone in because of the Carpe Horace, and had gone back because of the Carpe au Gras. They drank there, they ate there, they spouted there. They paid little, they paid badly. They did not pay at all, yet they were always welcome. Old man Hucheloup was a good sport. This good sport, Hucheloup, as we said, was a mustachioed keeper of the grittier sort of tavern, an amusing variety. He always looked as if he was in a bad mood, seemed bent on intimidating the clientele, growled at people coming into his place, and looked like he'd rather pick a fight with them than serve them soup. And yet, we say again, everyone was always welcome. This quirkiness ensured that the place was always full and brought him young men who would say to each other, "Come and see old man Hucheloup blow his top." He had been a fencing master. He had a way of bursting out laughing all of a sudden. Big, booming voice, but a good old fellow with it. He was at bottom a comedian behind a tragic mask. He liked nothing better than to scare you, a bit like those snuff boxes in the shape of a pistol. The shot is a sneeze. His wife, Mother Hucheloup, was an uncommonly ugly, bearded woman. Around 1830, old man Hucheloup died. The secret of the Carpe au Gras died with him. His widow, who was barely consolable, kept the tavern going, but the cooking degenerated and became execrable, and the wine, which had always been bad, was now shocking. Courfeyrac and his friends continued to haunt Corinth, though, out of pity, said Bossuet. Widow Hucheloup was short-winded and misshapen, full of country memories. She relieved their tiresomeness by her pronunciation. She had her own way of saying things that spiced up these springtime village reminiscences of hers. Once upon a time it had been her delight, she claimed, to hear the bread breasts sing in the hawthorns. The room on the upper floor where the restaurant was a great long well crammed with stools, stepladders, chairs, benches, and tables, and with a rickety old billiard table. You reached it by the spiral staircase that came out in a corner of the room in a square hole, like a ship's hatch. This room, lit by a single narrow window and an oil lamp that was always burning, was a real shambles. All the furniture with four legs behaved as though they had three. As sole decoration, the whitewashed walls had this quatrain in honor of Mother Hucheloup. She passes at 10 paces, she horrifies at 2. A wart lives up her nose, so risky, true. You're worried all the time she'll blow down the house, and that one fine day her nose will fall into her mouth. This was written in charcoal on the wall. Ma Hucheloup, true to life, went back and forth morning and night in front of those four lines with perfect serenity. Two servants, called Matelote, fish stew, and Giblotte, rabbit stew, whose real names no one ever knew, helped Ma Hucheloup deck the tables with the carafes of dark Rotgut wine and the various gruels that were served to the hungry in earthenware bowls. Matelote, fat, round, ruddy, and loud, former favorite sultaness of the late Hucheloup, was uglier than any mythological monster you care to name. And yet, as it is only fitting that the servant should always trail behind the mistress of the house, she was not as ugly as Ma Hucheloup. Giblotte, long, delicate, white with a lymphatic whiteness, with rings round her eyes, drooping eyelids, always exhausted and overwhelmed, suffering from what we might call chronic fatigue, first up, last to bed, served everyone, even the other servant, silently and sweetly, smiling beneath the fatigue with a sort of sleepy, vague smile. There was a mirror above the bar. Before entering the restaurant room, you could read this line, written in chalk, over the door by Courfeyrac: "Revel if you can, and eat if you dare." Preliminary gaieties. L'Aigle de Meaux, as we know, lived rather more with Joly than anywhere else. He had a room the way a bird has a branch. The two friends lived together, ate together, slept together. They shared everything, even musichetta, a little. They were what the hooded friars call bini, a pair. On the morning of June 5th, they went off to have breakfast at Corinth. Joly was all stuffed up with a bad head cold that L'Aigle was beginning to share. L'Aigle's coat was threadbare, but Joly was dapper. It was about 9 in the morning when they pushed open the door of Corinth. They went up to the first floor. Matelote and Giblotte greeted them. "Oysters, cheese, and ham," said L'Aigle. And they sat down at a table. The tavern was empty. They were the only ones there. Giblotte recognized Joly and L'Aigle and plunked a bottle of wine on the table. As they were downing their first oysters, a head appeared at the stairwell hatch, and a voice said, "I was just passing when I caught a heady whiff of breeze from the street. I'm coming in." It was Grantaire. Grantaire took a stool and planted himself at the table. Giblotte, seeing Grantaire, put another 2 bottles of wine on the table. That made 3. "Are you going to drink those 2 bottles?" L'Aigle asked Grantaire. Grantaire answered, "Everyone else is ingenious, and you alone are ingenuous. No one ever balked at 2 bottles." The others had begun by eating. Grantaire began by drinking. Half a bottle was swiftly dispatched. "Have you got hollow legs?" said L'Aigle. "You obviously have," said Grantaire. He emptied his glass and added, "Dear me, L'Aigle of the funeral orations, your coat has had it." "I should hope so," L'Aigle retorted. "It means we get on well together, my coat and I. It's taken on all my wrinkles. It doesn't get in my way at all. It has molded itself to all my deformities. It goes along with all my movements. I only know it's there because it keeps me warm. Old coats are exactly the same as old friends."
"True," cried Joly, chiming in. "An old coat is an old goat."
"Especially," said Grantaire, "in the mouth of a man stuffed up with a cold."
"Grantaire," L'Aigle asked, "did you come from the boulevard?"
"No.
We just saw the head of the procession go by, Joly and I."
"It is a marvelous sight," said Joly.
"The street is so quiet," cried L'Aigle. "Who would ever suspect that Paris is in pandemonium? You can really tell it used to be all convents around here. De Brule and Sauval list all of them, and so does the Abbé Leboeuf. They were all around here. The place was crawling with them. The shod, the unshod, the tonsured, the bearded, the greys, the blacks, the whites, the Franciscans, the Minimi, the Capuchins, the Carmelites, the Lesser Augustines, the Greater Augustines, the Old Augustines. The place was riddled with them."
"Don't talk to me about monks," Grantaire cut in. "It makes you want to scratch yourself." Then he exclaimed, "Ugh, I've just swallowed a bad oyster. Looks like my hypochondria's back. The oysters are off. The servants are dogs. How I hate the human race. I was in the Rue Richelieu just now, and I went past the big public library. That great mound of oyster shells they call a library, it makes me sick just thinking about it. All that paper, all that ink, all that scribbling. Someone wrote all that. What moron once said that man was a biped without feathers? And then I ran into a pretty girl I know, lovely as springtime, a girl worthy of being called Floréal. And she was delighted, overjoyed, delirious, in seventh heaven, the poor silly goose, because yesterday some ghastly banker, pitted with smallpox, deigned to fancy her. Alas, a woman watches the quack treating her as keenly as her case of thrush. Cats chase mice as well as birds. This little madam, not even 2 months ago, was sitting pretty in a garret, fitting the little copper rings in the eye-holes of corsets, what do you call those things? She sewed, she slept on a camp bed, she lived with a flower-pot for company. She was content. Now she's a lady banker. This transformation happened overnight. I met the victim this morning, jubilant. The awful part of it is that the brazen hussy was just as pretty today as she was yesterday. Her financier didn't show on her face. Roses are better or worse than women in that you can see when the grubs have been attacking them. Ah, there is no morality on this earth. I call as my witness the myrtle, symbol of love, the laurel, symbol of war, the olive, that ninny, symbol of peace, the apple that nearly choked Adam with its pips, and the fig leaf, ancestor of the petticoat. As to justice, do you want to know what justice is? The Gauls covet Clusium. Rome defends Clusium and asks them what wrong Clusium has done to them. Brennus replies, "The wrong Alba did to you, the wrong Faidini did to you, the wrong the Equi, the Volsci, and the Sabines did to you. They were your neighbors. The Clusians are ours. We understand neighborliness the same way you do. You stole Alba, we are taking Clusium." Rome says, "You will not take Clusium. Brennus took Rome." Then he cried, "Vae victis! Woe to the vanquished! That's what justice is. Ah, in this world there are only beasts of prey, only eagles, It makes my skin crawl.
He held his glass out to Julie, who refilled it, then he drank, and proceeded almost without having been interrupted by this glass of wine, which no one noticed, not even himself.
Brennus, who takes Rome, is an eagle. The banker who takes a little working girl is an eagle. One is as shameless as the other, so we may as well believe in nothing. There's only one reality, drinking. Whatever your opinion, whether you are for the lean cock like the canton of Uri, or for the fat cock like the canton of Glarus, it matters little, so drink. You talk to me about the boulevard, the procession, etc. Well, well, so there's going to be another revolution, is there? This poverty of means amazes me on the part of the good Lord. He has to keep on greasing the groove of events without let-up. Things get stuck, they won't shift. Quick, a revolution. The good Lord's hands are black all the time from this dreadful, dirty oil. In its place, I'd keep it simple. I wouldn't keep cranking up my machinery in an endless restaging. I'd promptly lead the human race by the horns. I'd knit events together, stitch by stitch, without breaking the thread. I wouldn't have any tricks up my sleeve. I wouldn't have any fancy repertoire. What you lot call progress runs on two engines, people and events. But the sad thing is that from time to time something exceptional is called for. For events as for people, the stock company's not enough. There have to be geniuses among people, and among events, revolutions. Great accidents are the rule. The nature of things can't do without them. And going on the way, comets appear. You could be forgiven for thinking that heaven itself needs star attractions. The moment you least expect it, God plasters a meteor across the wall of the firmament. Some bizarre star shoots out, emphasized by an enormous tail. And that's the reason Caesar dies. Brutus strikes him with a knife, and God strikes him with a comet. Hey, presto! Up pops an aurora borealis, up pops a revolution, up pops a great man. 93 in big letters, Napoleon in the starring role, the comet of 1811 at the top of the bill. Ah, and what a beautiful bill it is. Blue, and all studded with stunning flashing lights. Boom, boom, what an amazing show. Look up, you gawking spectators. Everything's out of control. The star as well as the play. Good God, it's both too much and not enough. Such resources, plucked from the grab bag of the exceptional, seem magnificent, yet they are really rather poor. My friends, Providence is down to expedience. A revolution? What does that prove? That God is hard up. He stages a coup d'etat because there is a break in the connection between the present and the future, and because, even being God, he can't make the two ends meet. In fact, this confirms my conjectures about the state of Jehovah's fortunes. And to see so much uneasiness up above as well as down below, so much meanness and stinginess and miserliness and distress in heaven as well as on earth, from the bird who doesn't have a grain of millet, to little old me who doesn't have 100,000 livres a year in income, to see the fate of humanity, which is pretty threadbare, and even the fate of royalty, which is showing its warp, witness the hanging of the Prince de Condé. To see winter, which is nothing more than a rip in the zenith that the wind blows through, to see all those streaks like tatters in the brand-new crimson of the morning over the hilltops, to see the dewdrops, those fake pearls, to see the frost, that jewelry paste, to see humanity coming apart at the seams and events patched up, and so many spots on the sun, and so many holes in the moon, to see so much misery everywhere, I suspect God is not rich. He keeps up appearances, it's true, but I sense the straits he's in. He throws a revolution the way a merchant whose coffers are empty throws a ball. We must not judge gods by appearances. Beneath the gilding of the heavens, I glimpse a destitute universe. There is bankruptcy in creation. That's why I'm out of sorts. You see, it's June 5th. It's almost night. I've been waiting for the day to come since morning. It hasn't come yet, and I bet it won't come all day. That's like the lack of punctuality of a poorly paid clerk. Yes, everything's badly organized. Nothing hangs together. This old world is a shambles. I'm going over to the opposition. Everything's going to rack and ruin. The world is a pain in the neck. It's like children. The people who want them don't have any. Those who don't want them do. Net result? I'm riled. On top of that, L'Aigle du Meaux, that baldy, hurts my eyes. It humiliates me to think I'm the same age as that cueball. Otherwise, I criticize, but I don't insult. The world is what it is. I'm talking here without any malice and to ease my conscience. Receive, Eternal Father, the assurance of my sincere esteem. Ah, by all the saints on Olympus and by all the gods in heaven, I was not made to be Parisian. Meaning, to ricochet forever between two gangs, like a shuttlecock between two rackets, from the strutting flaneurs to the loudmouth louts. I was made to be a Turk, gazing all the livelong day at Oriental scatterbrains, performing that exquisite Egyptian dancing, lewd as the dreams of a celibate, or a hick from Beauce, or a Venetian gentleman surrounded by gentle dames, or a German princeling, providing half a foot soldier to the German Confederation and filling his spare time drying his socks on his hedge, that is, on his border. That's what I was born for. Yes, I say Turk, and I'm not about to unsay it. I don't understand why everyone's so hard on the Turks. Mohammed has his good side. Let's have some respect for the inventor of seraglios full of houris and of paradises full of odalisks. Let's not insult Mohammedanism, the only religion that comes complete with a henhouse. On that note, I insist on drinking. The earth is one huge silly prank, and it seems they're going to fight all these half-wits, bash each other's heads in, slaughter each other, in the middle of summer, in the month of Ferial, when they could be going off to the countryside with some luscious creature on their arm to breathe in that great cup of tea of freshly mown hay. They really are too silly for words. An old broken oil lamp I saw just a moment ago in a junk shop prompts me to make this point. It's time to illuminate the human race. Yes, I've come over all sad again. What a thing it is to swallow an oyster or a revolution the wrong way. I'm getting gloomy again. Oh, this rotten old world. We vie against one another, we depose one another, we prostitute ourselves, we kill one another, and then we put up with it all in the end. Here, Grantaire, after this fit of eloquence, had a well-earned fit of coughing. "Speaking of revolution," said Julie, "it would appear that Barius is decidedly avaricious." "Who of, do we know?" asked Legler.
"Doe."
"No?
Doe, I told you."
"The love life of Marius," cried Grantaire. "I can see it now. Marius is a mist, and he will have found himself some vapor. Marius is a born poet. Say poet and you say madman. Timbre's Apollo. Marius and his Marie, or his Maria, or his Mariette, or his Marion, they must make pretty hilarious lovers. I can see it all, ecstasies in which they forget to kiss. Chaste here below, but going at it for all their worth in infinity. They are souls with senses. They sleep together among the stars." Grantaire was getting stuck into his second bottle, and perhaps his second harangue, when a new creature emerged from the square hole at the top of the stairs. This was a boy of under 10, in rags, tiny, sallow, with a sharp little muzzle of a face, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, hair all over the place, soaked with rain, looking pleased. Making his choice without hesitation from among the three, even though he obviously didn't know any of them, the boy addressed L'Aigle de Meaux. "Are you Monsieur Bossuet?" he asked. "That's my nickname," answered L'Aigle. "What do you want?" "All right, a big fair-headed fellow on the boulevard says to me, 'Do you know Mother Hucheloup?' 'Yes,' I says, 'Rue Chanvrerie, widow of the old geezer.' He says to me, 'Get yourself over there. You'll find Monsieur Bossuet there. Tell him from me, A, B, C.' They're pulling your leg, aren't they? He gave me 6 sous. "Julie, lend me 10 sous, said L'Aigle. Then he turned to Grantaire. "Grantaire, lend me 10 sous. That made 20 sous, which L'Aigle promptly gave the boy. "Thank you, monsieur," the boy said. "What's your name?" asked L'Aigle.
"Turnip, Gavroche's friend."
"Stay here with us," said L'Aigle. "Have breakfast with us," said Grantaire. The child replied,
"I can't, I'm in the procession. I'm the one crying, 'Down with Polignac!'"
And kicking his foot way out behind him, which is the most respectful of all possible bows, he took off. Once the child was gone, Grantaire took the floor again. "That is pure gamin, pure Paris boy. There are many varieties in the gamin genus. The notary's boy is known as a gutter leaper, a saute ruisseau. The cook's boy is known as a pot stirrer, a marmiton. The baker's boy is known as a pastry puff, a mitron. The footman's boy is known as a groom. The cellar boy is known as a latherer, a mousse. The soldier boy is known as a drummer boy, a tapin. The painter's boy is known as an apprentice dauber, a rapin. The merchant's boy is known as an errand boy, a runner, a trottin. The boy courtier is known as a junior gentleman in waiting, a monin. The king's boy is known as a dauphin. The boy god is known as a bambino. Legler, meanwhile, was musing. He said in a small voice, ABC. That'd be Lamarque's funeral. The big fair-headed fellow, observed Grantaire. That'd be Enjolras alerting you.
Will we go? Said Bossuet. It's raining, said Joly. I swore I'd go through fire, not water. I don't want to catch a cold.
I'm staying put, said Grantaire. I prefer breakfast to a hearse. Conclusion, we're staying, Legler summed up. Well, then we'd better drink. Anyway, you can miss the funeral without missing the riot.
Ah, the riot. I'm all for it, cried Joly.
Legler rubbed his hands together. So we're going to go back to the revolution of 1830. Actually, it's a bit tight in the arms for the people now. I really couldn't care less about your revolution, said Grantaire. I don't abhor this particular government. It's a crown tempered with a cotton cap. It's a scepter ending in an umbrella. In fact, today, I'm just reminded by the weather, Louis-Philippe could use his royalty at both ends, extend the scepter end against the people, and open up the umbrella end against the skies. The room grew dark. Huge clouds now completely blotted out the sun. There was no one in the tavern or on the street, everybody having gone to see the events.
"Is it midday or midnight?" cried Bossuet. "You can't see a bloody thing. Giblotte, some light on the subject."
Grantaire went on, forlornly drinking.
"Enjolras looks down on me," he murmured. "Enjolras must have said, Joly is sick, Grantaire is drunk." So he sent Turnip for Bossuet. If he'd come to get me, I'd have gone with him. Too bad for Enjolras. I won't be going to his funeral.
This resolution taken, Bossuet, Joly, and Grantaire did not budge from the tavern. At around 2 in the afternoon, the table they were leaning on was covered in empty bottles. 2 candles were burning on it, one in a bright green copper candlestick, the other in the neck of a cracked carafe. Grantaire had led Joly and Bossuet to the wine. Bossuet and Joly had jollied Grantaire up again. Speaking of Grantaire, since midday he had progressed beyond wine, a mediocre source of dreams. Wine, with serious drunkards, has only a succès d'estime. When it comes to inebriety, there is black magic and white magic. Wine is merely white magic. Grantaire was a daring drinker of dreams. The black hole of a fearful drunkenness gaping open before him, far from stopping him in his tracks, drew him in. He had abandoned the bottle and taken to the tankard. The tankard is a bottomless pit. Not having either opium or hashish to hand and wanting to fill his brain with twilight dimness, he had resorted to that frightening mix of eau-de-vie, stout and absinthe that produces such terrible sluggishness. It is from these 3 vapors, beer, eau-de-vie, and absinthe, that the soul is turned to lead. They are 3 forms of darkness. The celestial butterfly drowns in them, and in a membranous smog, vaguely condensed into a bat's wing, 3 mute furies, nightmare, night, and death, form and flit over the sleeping psyche. Grantaire had not yet reached that dismal point, far from it. He was wildly gay, and Bossuet and Joly kept pace with him. They clinked glasses. Grantaire added rambling gestures to the eccentric emphasis of his words and ideas. He sat straddling his stool, resting his left hand on his knee with dignity, his arm at a right angle, and with his cravat loose and his glass full in his right hand, he tossed these solemn words to